The next case is 99-1107, State of Ohio versus Marie Homan. Justice Resnick has recused herself from this case. We're very pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Resnick, Judge Kenneth Rocco, who's the judge of the Court of Appeals, sitting in the 8th Appellate District.
Start saying that you can just substantially comply with all of the statutes, and then supposing the person charged with DUI says, well, I substantially complied, I was not over 0.10, I was only 0.09, still might have been impaired and still can be convicted of DUI, but just not with the test. We substantially complied, shouldn't even try him.
There's two points that you raise there, Justice Ellis. Both of those are important in this case. One of those points is, first of all, that this is not a blood concentration alcohol case. This case proceeded forward under 4911-1981, which is simply an impairment case. The appellate in this matter, the appellee in this matter, has relied on language that's found in the DUI student manual that isn't the conclusion of a study that was conducted for research and development to compare the 0.10 level to the findings that were done in field sobriety testing. That has nothing to do with an A1 case that might be appropriate in an A3 case, but under Bresson, as this court has declared, field sobriety tests cannot even be used to show alcohol concentration level.
Yeah, but this case isn't here because of that. We didn't take it whether it's an A1 or an A3 case because we've had legion of those, haven't we? There's plenty of law on that. The issue is, should the state have to specifically comply with the statute? And the way I read the Court of Appeals opinion, they've laid it out pretty clearly that the statute says A, B, C, and you want to say A, B, and partly C.
What we'd like to say is that it should be viewed as a weight and credibility issue. It should be a substantial compliance issue. There was not strict compliance. The state will concede there wasn't strict compliance with the guidelines that were issued. And the state will concede that in many instances when officers may stop in various conditions out on the road, in different areas, different times, different lights, different weather conditions, there's going to be times when it's not going to be humanly possible to have strict compliance. In those instances, what the court needs to do is to use a standard of substantial compliance, which this court has. In these types of circumstances, as we outlined in our brief, traditionally in these types of circumstances, a substantial compliance standard has been applied.
What would be a substantial compliance if you didn't burn those
on the moving target?
Raining, it's muddy.
Substantial compliance.
Is that a substantial compliance, and that's just up to the defendant regarding his or her inadequate performance was due to the muddy,
two or three times,
intolerable conditions, the stone, the smell, the burn,
I
would suggest just quite frankly, that's exactly what happened here. The defendant did come in, and the defendant did argue that, in fact, that the officer didn't follow each of the instructions.
Is there no threshold below which you would say that it's not substantial? We want to. It seems the way you want to go is to say,
sure.
It's fair here. Why is it necessary to do the test if the conditions don't measure up? Why not?
All these other observations.
Just have the officer say.
Can you say in this case that yes,
the highway conditions,
but in this case,
the time that I stopped this person was not suitable for that test,
and
so I didn't administer it. It would have been fair. Isn't that plausible? Mm-hmm.
That certainly can happen, and I'm sure that it does happen. The reason that the officers use the field sobriety testing is that it does give them a fair indication of whether there's been any impairment, and it's a useful tool. The state's not arguing here today that there was necessarily substantial compliance on behalf of this officer in this case. What we're arguing is that the Court of Appeals never reached that question. They never decided whether there was substantial compliance. They decided that there was not strict compliance.
And
that's the real problem that we have with the case.
If indeed a test is unreliable when conducted outside the standards set forth, that seemed to be the basis for the Court of Appeals' opinion, that if the test is not conducted in accordance with the standards, then the test itself is unreliable, which would do away with the argument about weight. I mean, it can't be a weight issue if it's unreliable. right?
And Justice Scobetter, I think it's very important to look at where the Court of Appeals took this language with regard to the validity of these tests. It's taken from the end of a
we
snuff
the same
that compares to alcohol concentration
the same question.
To be able to write a test.
And that's
it is the standard they want tested.
But that should be the argument that you want to focus upon, because otherwise, if it is a reliability, you want to tell us that the basis for the Court of Appeals finding it unreliable without strict compliance is not a basis upon which this court should also rely. You want to say that's what's the problem.
That's exactly what we are trying to say.
Mm-hmm.
Is it within the discretion of the officer to give these tests?
It is within his discretion to give them, within his discretion to choose which of the tests that he does use.
Now, then he must make a decision whether or not upon his observation of the person going across the line and the smelling of alcohol and the admission of drinking, he then must make a decision whether or not he will perform these tests.
That would be an obligation.
So it's not necessary to perform these tests in order to charge someone with drunken driving.
No, but again, it's a very useful tool for the officers, and we're trying not to have that removed from their hands. Because what it's going to lead to is, for every minor technical point that isn't followed in the manual, you're going to lose an otherwise valid test. The appellate court's question of validity with these tests, the study says that it goes to validity as to a 1-0. It doesn't go to validity as to impairment itself. And the trial court treated it appropriately by saying, we're going to take these tests and we're going to look at them in the totality of the circumstances along with all the other indications of impairment.
Counsel,
and it does lead to...
Is there anything that prevents where the highway conditions are unsuitable, and it's the fact that it's the case of Justice Sweeney has put on, you have other things giving you the basis to demand the person submit to the breathalyzer or charge. Is there anything in the rules or statute that prohibits the administering of that test at the station at the same time you're administering the breathalyzer? In ideal circumstances.
There would be anything that prevents that.
Didn't that routinely used to be done?
In my experience, the judge of the field driving tests are conducted in the field and the course of their interest. With regard to the guidelines themselves, I think it's important also to support them. These are not statutory guidelines. These are guidelines that are contained in the student manual. This is not a statutory mandate that they're being followed. Which should give a lower standard, again, than what this court found in Plumber with regard to the Ohio Department of Health regulation. And I think if you look historically at the areas of law in which substantial compliance has been used, this fits in very well with regard to those particular provisions. The instances such as the Ohio Department of Health regulations, conducting radio frequency surveys of VDCs, and the 20-minute observation period is also required. Those are the areas where this court has looked at it and said, okay, we are going to use substantial compliance. It is one of the higher levels of strict compliance that's been imposed in the past, and we believe that should be fit here. What happens, if you allow it to go to substantial compliance, what happens is it comes down to a weak credibility issue, which is what it should be. The jury or the judge, as prior to that, can look at the officer and say, okay, the officer missed this step. How did that affect it? Should we do something about that? That's where it should lie. We ask the court to reverse based on that position in our first argument with regard to the Court of Appeals. With regard to the second proposition of law, let me try and tie that up quickly. With regard to that, there was also a child endangerment action filed here. The child endangerment action, as we believe we stated in the brief under State versus Hunt, is a allied defense of similar tort, and therefore it must be tried together with the
DUI
case. Since they
can't
be trying to get the legislature has said that you can't try the defendant for each of these cases specifically in the statute. Since they need to be tried together, then any motion holding time in one would necessarily hold time in the other. The defendant's argument that he's somehow prejudiced by this because the other case was not filed yet is false, because he certainly had notice of the motion that he had filed on the motion to suppress.
Can the cases be tried separately?
These cases could not be tried separately, because certainly they're tailing offenses similar in court, and if there were to be a finding of innocent one, then it would be a double jeopardy process. We wouldn't be able to try it on the other case. And if we're not saying they have to be tried together, defense counsel could always come in and plead the first day to the child endangering, and the DUI would have to go away because we have a double jeopardy process.
Their offenses both the same in court. One's child endangering and one's DUI?
That's correct.
Aren't there different elements?
Well, if we look at the statute under 29-19-22, it says that no person shall operate a vehicle within the state in violation of Division A, Section 45-11-19 of the revised code for children of 18 years or age in the vehicle. So you have to violate 45-11-19A in order to violate 29-19-22. So you have to have both offenses. So if they're not trying together, the defendant can come in and say, okay, I did a child endangering, then we're going to have a double jeopardy problem. We'll be able to try them on the DUI. Because all the elements of the DUI are in the child endangering case. And we'll be done, we'll be out the door. The legislature intended these cases to be tried at one trial. Any continuance would have to be
made. Why not make it an enhancement? This is not merely an enhancement. A child endangering is not merely an enhancement.
No, it's a separate charge, and the legislature provided for it.
If the legislature intended to be tried together, then why not make child endangering an enhancement?
They could have done it. However, the way that they chose to do it, the only way to treat it is as a mandatory trial together, because otherwise they're not going to do this after going forward. And I would ask that the court reverse on that basis.
Thank you, Mr. Conway. Mr. Kuharski.
May it please the court, I'm Timothy Kuharski, and I'm here to represent Marie Homan. There are two issues for this court today. Whether the state violated the speedy trial statute 29-45-71 when it serially charged Ms. Homan with the DUI, and then thereafter charged her with a child endangering, and two, whether this court would require officers to act professionally and do and comply with their training that they were taught, as well as with their training that they received at the OPADA, at the Ohio State Patrol Academy, or whether the court will permit them to do it however they want to do it and then claim that it's substantial compliance.
These tests are not by statute of correction. These are just internal procedures to aid an officer to know when to arrest, correct?
And that is correct, Your Honor. These tests, the Quanza tests, they were developed by the Southern California Research Institute at the behest of the Ohio Department for Happy Well.
The failure to follow the test is not even a statutory violation.
No, it is not a statute.
Internal procedure issue.
It is.
Why does this is not a credibility issue for the jury as to whether the test is sufficient or not? You present the state says you did X, Y, Z, and you only did two passes instead of five, and you get up there and say, here's all the standards, and you have to do five to be reliable. It's just a credibility issue, just like any other scientific test that you would present to the jury.
These are quasi-scientific tests. The reliability of these tests are so low to begin with. The HGN test has a reliability of 77% to detect whether an individual tests above 0.10.
And aren't you allowed to present that evidence to a jury?
Yes, but Your Honor, it becomes a reliability issue as to whether, in fact, it is relevant at all. If you're going to deviate from the standardized procedures of the field sobriety test, the procedures that every other state in this union use, but Ohio is going to be the only state that permits its officers to do it not according to A, B, C. Well, we're going to do A. I think C is a little bit too difficult for me at this time, so we're not going to do C. Let me D and E.
You say
all that's in the jury. And they can judge whether it's reliable or not. It's not statutory.
It is not statutory required. However, the officers receive their training that this is the way it has to be done. This is their manual. This is the way their superiors are told them to do it. That's what's in their manual. The officer in this particular instance admitted in trial as well as the suppression hearing that if I don't do them according to my training, they're invalid. I can't rely on them. And that's simply all we're asking the court to do is to follow that training up, follow what the officer's own statements. And if I don't do it properly, this court and any trier of fact can't rely on the test results.
The basis for the court taking that role would be what? Just that we should enforce officer training?
That is proper thing to do.
I know, but is that, I mean, what legal principle should we use?
The protection of innocent voters being arrested for DUI. If, Your Honor, if you have, as the other justices were talking, a mighty highway or something, what happens is the individual may sway, may fall, may do
yeah,
something.
But I'm not expert on that, so I just am not. And I know I'm not, so I'm not sure you're persuading me today, teaching me that probably won't be my reasoning. But I'm wondering if you'd address I guess if we're not finished with that one, you said the other states, that other states do won't allow any kind of admission of test results if they're not strictly followed. You've cited those to us, but these are indeed, they are not admitted into evidence.
That is correct.
Okay. Any distinctions between that they were included in the statute, or what led courts to say?
The same basis that we're relying on is that the officer's training.
Good practice.
Has required that if they are going to.
Not some scientific reliability kind of focus, like a Daubert kind of thing.
Not technically, Your Honor. There's a manual that Southern California Research Institute said, look, only when these criteria are used, the standardized criteria are utilized.
Is it reliable?
Rely on.
Okay, so was reliability?
Yes. And we would submit that the trial court shouldn't even get to that based on this court's own ruling in Rustin. The two foundational predicates to admit the HGN test would be the officer's training and his ability to conduct the test. As well as the second predicate being the officer's actual technique in utilizing it. We submit that the actual technique meant the proper technique, not some, well, I almost did it right, I substantially did it right, because otherwise you equate a properly trained officer that does it improperly with an improperly trained officer who also does it improperly. There would be no distinguishment between those two individuals.
Is there another, this is not a statutory reason, but Justice Cook mentioned Daubert. Of course, we have this whole field of the whole question of submitting scientific evidence to jurors and then asking them to sort it out. We place great burdens, I think, on jurors sometimes to try to make factual determinations that are very difficult to make. Is another reason to say, to apply the manual strictly, is that here's a procedure that is clearly prescribed, that everyone agrees that this is the way to do it. Why give that to a jury? Why say to a jury, well, we didn't quite do it right, but we're going to let you decide whether it meets some test of all circumstances, some test such as that. Isn't, for the administration of our system, isn't it better just to, probably asking the wrong person this, because I know you, I guess you say yes, but isn't it, just for the system, if we can identify some issues that we can say to juries, here's a test that was administered properly, it's reliable, you can put that issue aside in terms of determining the factual nature of whether it's reliable or not. Here, the suggestion is that by the prosecutor, by the prosecution court, is that, well, the officer didn't follow the manual, and therefore the test is probably unreliable. If we agree that the suggestion that it is unreliable, it's not followed. What's your response to that? Is that a bootstrap argument, or is it a valid argument?
It's a valid argument, and also in addition to that, these tests are quasi-scientific. When they're presented by the officers to the jury and to the driver of fact, they are taught, they are said, which tests did you do? Tests. And that phrase is repeated throughout the trial. So the jury is under the impression that these are scientific tests, that the court has determined that these are reliable, that in fact they can themselves rely on the results of these tests, when in fact they're actually exercises. And what would happen is the jury would be unduly persuaded to rely on the test that the creators of these own tests have determined to be unreliable unless you follow the manual. And so you're essentially doing a smoke and mirrors with the jury, saying, look, these are tests, but we're not going to tell you that if you don't do them properly, they're invalid, because they're going to be under the impression that, in fact, they are tests, that there are scientific bases.
Let me turn the coin for you. The Court of Appeals said that there was sufficient evidence. It appeared that the officer did have, obviously, other evidence from other tests to suggest that your client was intoxicated or the influence or impaired. And the Court of Appeals says that there was sufficient evidence, and then, however, we find that your client was prejudiced by the presentation results of the AGN test and so forth, and that this improperly admitted evidence caused the jury to lose its way and create a manifest miscarriage of justice. How do we know that? How do we know that the jury didn't decide that, well, the officer had a lot of other evidence to, we'll put aside the HGN test, we won't consider that, but he did have these other observations of her smelled alcohol and, of course, the other observations. How do we know that the Court of Appeals, that's a rather sweeping, sort of unequivocal conclusion, is it not?
Yes, it is, Your Honor, and I would submit that it's actually a correct assessment of the situation. A review of the entire trial, that there was very little evidence to indicate, other than glassy bloodshot eyes, slurred, there wasn't even slurred speech, glassy bloodshot eyes, and an odor of alcohol. There was no
and he saw, her, we, he saw her go across the center line a couple of times.
Right. And she explained that as she was talking to her daughter. But we would submit that by itself is not proof beyond reasonable doubt that someone is appreciably impaired to as related to intoxication. But what the jury did was rely on the officer's test results and his testimony regarding the test results, and that is the only basis for them to convict.
Were there interrogatories? Do we know that? Were there interrogatories?
No, Your Honor. It was just a learned position from reviewing the transcript, reviewing the trial itself. There was very little evidence otherwise. If the state's position is, look, it has to be a substantial compliance argument, well, there is no requirement that the officers do these tests. If you're going to do something, do it right. That's what my grandfather's told me. Everyone has learned throughout the years, if you're going to do something, do it right. And if you can't do it right, don't do it. If you can't do it properly at both sides, as Justice Roberts said, take them back to the station house. There are a number of police stations in the state of Ohio that routinely take the suspects back to the station house and videotape. That there is no claim that defense counsel can make at that point, well, the cars were whizzing by, the wind was affecting it. There's nothing. It's a sterile condition. It's all videotaped. That's the case.
Do you ever try doing that one leg standing test sober?
Yes, Your Honor, I can't do it.
So you can?
I cannot do it.
Okay. So I just wondered if we should apply a substantial compliance standard for the test taker as well. I think they objected because she went up 6 inches, raised her arm 6 inches or something to balance herself and hopped twice.
I would like to make that argument to say, look, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If she only tested a 0.09 or a 0.12, well, that's pretty close to being under the legal limit. Or she only raised it 6 inches, or she only raised it 18 inches. Well, that's pretty close to the 6 inches that she was required to, so you can't really indicate that she fell. And at that point, what would happen is floodgates would be open for appeals to determine what is, in fact, substantial compliance and what isn't. And does it, in fact, apply to the defendant as well as the state? So does an officer's ability to skip steps and not properly instruct somebody provide a basis to present evidence of proof beyond a reasonable doubt? And in this case, and the reason why the manual has to be followed is that this officer told this woman to take 9 steps there, take 9 steps back, keep her hands at her side. He never told her to touch Hilda's hope. And yet he indicated, and I put it in the brief, at what page of the transcript, he relied on that as a failure.
If you don't tell someone what you're grading on, how can they possibly know what you want them to do?
Yet setting aside all these tests, I think maybe the Chief Justice made reference to this too, my problem, the Court of Appeals specifically says they're going to weigh the evidence because they have a right to do that. But they also say there are sufficient, there was sufficient evidence going to the element of under the influence of alcohol. Doesn't that just make the test superfluous?
They said you don't have to do the test.
Yeah, so she's guilty just based on the sufficient evidence of the DUI without the testing.
I think the Court of Appeals decision as it relates to the sufficiency of the evidence relates to probable cause to arrest this woman. And the court is saying, while we are not taking into consideration the test results on the HGN and the walk-to-turn test, there was other evidence that the officer acquired, that being the weaving in the lanes, the glass, the eyes, the odor of alcohol, to provide a basis or probable cause to believe that she was under the influence so that she could be taken into custody and tested further to determine whether or not she was in fact under the influence of alcohol. That is, and while we would agree with the decision at that point, that perhaps there was a sufficient amount of evidence to establish probable cause, there certainly wasn't a sufficient amount of evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this woman was guilty of the other's offense.
to testify regarding the reliability of a specific test, Instead, reliability is based upon strict compliance with the standardized methods and procedures of testing, right? Isn't that so? Could you accept the notion that in lieu of expert testimony, there is an expectation that the strict compliance with standardized procedures?
I think that given that this court is ruling in former and similar cases, indicating that substantial compliance is sufficient to trigger these types of rights and these types of proceedings, that substantial compliance would be sufficient. We should let the trial judge do their work on motions to suppress. We should let the defense counsel do their work with regard to knocking the test down and going to the weight of credibility. Let the jury and judge decide whether or not the tests are credible if they aren't done correctly. If they're done so incorrectly as to not substantially comply, let the motion to suppress reduce them. That's the way these cases have been tried throughout Ohio over time, and that's why we have had this case before this court before. Everyone has gone by substantial compliance.
Will a prosecutor have laid the proper foundation for admission of the officer's testimony about such tests without saying the tests have been administered in accordance with the manuals, the standardized training? Will there be a proper foundation?
I believe under Brest, the court required it to be a proper foundation.
I know.
And I believe that's an appropriate measure for motion to suppress the trial to determine whether there's substantial compliance with the manuals, non-standardized.
So foundation, you would say, would be laid so long as there's testimony about substantial compliance?
I believe that would be the appropriate thing to have in a motion to suppress. And I would say that even this court's opinion with regard to Brest, several of the elements that are considered to be stained are disclosed within that opinion itself. It's not the easiest thing to follow a guideline perfectly.
Well, but the patrol apparently thinks, and the law enforcement apparently thinks, that these guidelines have been developed by them. I mean, why do we then say, well, it's difficult for them to enforce them? If it is, there are alternatives. As the counsel suggests, you take the person to a place where the wind isn't blowing and the rain isn't falling, or the ground is firm. This is law enforcement's test.
And Your Honor, we believe that they're effective tests, they're good tests. We believe that normally, under conditions, they can be done appropriately. And by appropriately, we mean substantially complying with the mandate. To do anything perfectly is too high of a burden
Even though the instructions to the officers are substantial compliance is not, in effect, is not sufficient. We need to follow the manual by the numbers, or you won't have a reliable test. Am I overstating that, do you think? Or?
Again, what I would say is the question of reliability, Mr. Kowarski raised it and said the officer said yes, they're not reliable. The test manual has said that the validity as for one whole comparison may be compromised. Nobody from the Department of Transportation has said that there is no impairment value to a test that's not done in exact accordance. That has never been said. Again, look where that language came from that the Board of Appeals relied on. It comes from a conclusion to a research and development article. It's not in the context of impairment under an 81 standard. It doesn't say that if you do only two passes as opposed to four passes, then you won't show impairment. It says that if you don't do those, it may not correlate with one of VAC. That the court has gone too far with regard to compliance.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You may be advised of our opinion, Mark. Please adjourn court.